I agree with you, David. It has been wonderful to be here these days, and just to be invited to be here these days. Thank you, Hewlett, so much for this. You know, it has been said so often that Christianity is really the gift of Jesus and Paul, and that as Jesus founds the faith, Paul manages to lift up this magnificent edifice called Christianity and slip the explanations for it all under the edifice. And so Paul and Jesus, I think, have done this wonderful thing. However, I must confess that when I'm weary with Romans and can't understand it, or Galatians, it's fun to read the praxis stuff that D-Men programs are all about, I guess. And over in 1 Corinthians, the 9th chapter, we have one of those passages. It is not so full of theology. It is full of a workable philosophy for the kingdom of God, because he talks about the two most important aspects, which are preaching and evangelism. That's his focus. Each of them, he says, are a relational matter. I find this uncanny, that a man who doesn't appear to me to be very relational in the Bible can see that somehow, until we make friends with the world, we're not in any real danger of preaching to it, or nor necessarily of winning it to Christ. It's a relational foundation. It really is. I was speaking out in California at an evangelical covenant camp. Each day as I stood up to speak, a man drove up. I could see him out the back door on a Harley Davidson motorcycle. He parked it, came in, listened to my sermon, and left. He did this every day. Until Thursday, I said to the man leading music, "Who is this man?" And he said, "This is Mike Holmgren." I'm not a jock. I confessed that last night. So I didn't realize Mike Holmgren was coach of the Green Bay Packers. But he came back on Friday. And when the sermon was over on Friday, he came up to me and he said, "When we play Dallas at Thanksgiving, which was about 4 months away, would you do the devotional for the Green Bay Packers?" Realizing how many multimillionaires there were on the team, I thought the honorarium would be great. And so I said, "Sure." And after he walked out, I realized this was a bad mistake. I know nothing about football, and certainly about the Green Bay Packers. But I did what all of us do when we try to figure out how to be relational. We do some study. Audience analysis is the number one thing about preaching. You can't preach to people you don't know. And I didn't know anything about the Green Bay Packers, so I started reading sports magazine. I left off the rich books of Isaiah and some of the New Testaments and dallied where most Americans dally in those magazines. I learned the names of prayers. I even watched football games for the first time in my life. It's new for me. As I told you last night, I'm every woman's dream. I hate football and love shopping. This was a new kind of thing for me. I learned a lot. I even researched the whole area around Green Bay and learned that the Great Lakes was a kind of waterway where early French missionaries paddled up and down the Great Lakes system getting furs and that sort of thing. I read about Lambeau Field, the Arctic Stadium in America. I learned all about Vince Lombardi, who had said every quotable thing C.S. Lewis hadn't. And then it came time to preach it. It was Thanksgiving. I went to the Quorum Hotel in Dallas where the Packers were gathered and thought to myself, what could I say to them in any relational way that a wimp would have to relate to million-dollar athletes? And I thought to myself, if I could tell them how to win against Dallas, this would probably be of some use to them. So I told them that I read them the passage from Hebrews 12 and told them that if they could lay the baggage on the sideline, they'd probably be able to run with patience the race that's set before them. And if they could lay all the baggage, the drug reports, the bad press clippings, the times when they were traded or almost traded, if they could put it all down, they could win, because Dallas can't do that. And they're all Texans, and so they just cannot lay it on the sideline. But anyway, that's what I told them. And then I said to them, the key to winning today is a relational thing. Can you remember how you used to play football with your dad and what fun it was before you signed the contract to do it? Then I did the most hazardous thing of all. I'd written a poem for the Green Bay Packers, and I read it to them. "Little boy, where are you? I've been looking everywhere for you. I got a big game to play today, and I want to play football like I used to play it. I need your back, little boy. What I really liked about you was that you got excited about the right things, like flexing that little lump of a bicep and asking your dad to feel it. Like sawing back and forth over the center bar of your bike, wobbling your way to market with your pant leg rolled up so you wouldn't get your jeans caught in the chain. And back then, you cried about the right things, like when your puppy got run over, not after you read the sports page after a dumb play. And you didn't limit your French fries either, because salt and grease taste good together. And you didn't worry about what people said you didn't like, because to try to please people you don't like is stupid. And you kept your goals simple, too, because you knew the things you really needed to make you happy were pretty simple, like finding that first black hair that told you you'd someday be like your daddy. Or when the corner grocer gave you a baby Ruth because you played so well. Or when your junior high coach welcomed you into manhood by using that not too bad a cuss word that says, we men got to use those kind of words so we won't sound too much like girls. I need you back, little boy, because I've been looking everywhere for you, and I can still remember that thin little arm in the oversized sleeve. You threw the ball because you wanted to win, and you threw it good, too. Oh, your pass wobbled a little bit. You couldn't get it as far downfield as you wanted it to go. But good was how you felt when you threw it, and good was how you dreamed. And you played football because you loved it, not because you'd signed a contract to do it. And you played real good because your mind was as clean as your heart, and nobody had junked it up by selling you some bogus national image about television angles and instant replays. I need you back, little boy. I've gotten too concerned about how I look, or whether I'll get off the bench, or how I'll explain myself to the board, or whether I'll be invited to the press conference. I've forgotten how to do my own driving. I've forgotten how to be my own man. Where are you, little boy? It's Thanksgiving. I got a big game to play. I've been looking everywhere for you. It's a matter of relationships. And Paul says that in 1 Corinthians 9, verse 16. Here's what he says about preaching and evangelism. When I preach the gospel, he says, I cannot boast, for I am compelled to preach. I love that phrase. I'm not sure all that it means there, but when he says, woe be unto me if I do not preach the gospel, he wrote the outline for every Christian life worth living. And you know why you're in the world if you can say, woe be unto me if I do not blank, and finish in 25 words or less. Your self-definition rises out of such a simple thing. Paul said, woe be unto me. And you know, when he said, woe be unto us if we preach or we lead a church, the truth is, there's nothing in this verse that says you have to be good at it. Nothing. It just says you got to do it. That's the amazing thing. There are plenty of evidences, even though Paul says, woe be unto me, that he was not a great preacher. For instance, over in 2 Corinthians 10:9, the Corinthians say in the second letter, I don't want to seem to be frightening you with my letters, says the apostle. For some of you say, Paul, your letters are weighty and forceful, but in person you're unimpressive, and your preaching amounts to nothing. So how could Paul say, woe be unto me if I do not preach, and the Corinthians say, woe be unto us when he does? I think the answer is clear. He doesn't have to be that. We don't have records of having big crowds like we do with Apollos or Peter. He just had to do it. And if there's any doubt in your mind, I love this one over in Acts 20, verse 9. While Paul was preaching, there was seated in the window a young man named Eutychus, who was sinking into a deep sleep as Paul talked on and on. When he was sound asleep, he fell to the ground from the third story and was picked up dead. Paul was literally knocking him dead with his sermons. Paul went down, put his arms around him, and said, don't be alarmed. He's alive. It's only fair that Paul resurrected him. He had slain him with an overlong sermon. Then he went upstairs. After he resurrects the man, he goes back upstairs. He breaks bread and eats. And then it says, after talking on till daylight, he left. Paul wasn't the kind of preacher you could interrupt with a mere death and resurrection. He just goes right on preaching. But if you blot his name out of history, half the New Testament doesn't exist. You don't have to be the best. You just have to do what God says to do. And somehow, once we learn to receive that definition and can say, woe be unto me, we become, I think, in a healthy sense, useful to God. We can accept ourselves when we agree to this definition. He says in verse 17, if I preach voluntarily, I have a reward. If not voluntarily, he says, I'm simply discharging the trust committed to me after 35 years as a pastor and 17 or 18 as a professor. I can guarantee you the most beautiful thing I know is just to give it to God and to watch the altar fill or be empty, or to preach because I'm excited and the deacons finally have done the will of God and prayed. But when they don't, I go at 11 o'clock anyway, discharging a trust committed to me. How important this is. What then is my reward in preaching this, that I may offer it free of charge and not make use of my rights in preaching it? I love that, folks. No advantage is promised you. Hardship is certain. Pay is probably low. It's okay. You're working for the best boss in the world. And what you do is you stand in the middle of it all and realize that there gathers around you a relational response. And it's that that quickens the gospel and makes the church exciting. I didn't say that, but in the front of my Bible, I have all the signatures of the Green Bay Packers. The Bible's for sale. But the thing I like most about this is I remember hearing Brett Favre on the day after he heard my sermon. And he said, the commentator asked him at a press conference, what are you going to do? How are you going to play? Oh, he said, I think I'll just play like I used to when I was a little boy. Now, maybe he just thought that up. But I like believing that for one moment, a millionaire listened and heard what I had to say. A relational power belongs to the sermon. But it's not just the sermon that the relational power comes. The relational power also comes, and it altogether depends in evangelism. Though he says in verse 19, I am free, I belong to no man, I make myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. To the Jews, I became like a Jew to win the Jews. To those under the law, I changed personalities. I became like one under the law, though I myself am not under the law, so as to win those not under the law. To those not having the law, I became like one not having the law, though I'm not free from God's law, but under Christ's law, so as to win those not having the law. To the weak, I became weak. To win the weak, I have become all things to all men, so that by all possible means I might save some. You know, folks, I don't brag about this. I just love winning people to Jesus Christ. I did that for 25 years. A lot of things about my ministry changed over 25 years. One thing never did change. The last day I was at the church, I went out, knocked on doors, and led people to Christ. The situation is always the same. It begins in no statement of glory. I don't have a 10-minute gospel rape that I lay the mojo on people. I just try to be a friend. And within an hour, it's easy for me to talk about the most wonderful subject in the world, why Jesus should be Lord of someone's life. And so they came. Year by year, it happened over and over. And the situation was always the same. I would go to a door, and I would play Mr. PR, Mr. Relational. I remember knocking on a door in May, just before I left the church. A man drove up in his driveway, and he gets out of his car. It's May. He's wearing a robe, a doctoral robe. He's got slash marks on his sleeve. And I don't know him, but I can see he's got a PhD in his hand. And I said to him, you got your PhD? I said, what'd you do your dissertation in? Oh, he said, I'm an entomologist. I did my insect, he said, I did my PhD on insects trapped in amber. Man, I want to jumpstart this conversation. But I don't know anything about this kind of thing. And I said to him, probably what sounded really stupid, how do insects get trapped in amber? Got a minute, he said. He's getting excited. I said, sure. He invites me in, and he gives me a cup of coffee. I sit down, and he tells me about about insects and how they ran down trees in prehistoric times, and bits of sap. I understood sap. I've been a pastor for years. The sap runs down over the little insect, encases him in a little blob of yellow. It hardens, and there he is, petrified through time. I said, "This is fascinating." He said, "Have you ever seen an insect trapped in amber?" "No," I said, "I never have." "Oh," he said, would you like to have a look?" Now, what am I going to say? Sure, he's really excited. He goes over to the table. He's got a microscope there. He tightens the barrel down. It kind of focuses a moment, and his face lights up. He's seeing something. I want to see it. He's looking at that telescope like most guys look at Julia Roberts. I want to see what's under there on that slide. I went over and put my eye, and I adjusted the wheel a little bit, and it came into view, an insect trapped in amber. It was horrible. It was a Stephen King novel. This little thing with, I don't know, its face all screwed up in pain like a Baptist after a business meeting. And its little hands raised and frozen in time like a Pentecostal frozen in time. And he said, I've got some more. So he shoved another yellow rock. He shoved yellow rocks. I watched little yellow rocks. I watched insects trapped in amber until mercifully he is out of yellow rocks. And then I said to him, "It's been most interesting, but would you mind if I ask you a question?" He said, "What?" I said, if you were to die right now, do you know for sure you'd go to heaven?" He said, "Well, I have no idea." "How could you know that?" he said. I said, "Let me show you some stuff." And in just a little bit, I was actually praying with the man and led the man to Christ. What am I doing here? I'm just playing the little game of like. I want him to be like me. He's got to like me. It's the worst rule in the world, I know, but I never led anybody to like Jesus that didn't like me first. A bad trade, I understand. But until they like me, they're not much likely to like him. And you know, I just thought about it. You know, to the weak, I became weak. To win the weak, to the Jews, I became a Jew. To win the Jews, to a guy who likes insects trapped in amber. I want to be a guy who likes insects trapped in amber. All things for all people in the most relational game with the highest stakes I'll ever know. I don't win them all. It's hard for me to relate, honestly. One of the hard problems I've had is relating to people who like country western music. I preached up in Branson, Missouri. I don't see what difference it makes if they get their pickup and their third wife back. But they take this pretty seriously. I listened to all this stuff, and they said that there was that some bandits had come through the country there. They had taken Andy Williams, who has a pavilion there, and Billy Ray Cyrus, who has a pavilion there, and they took them out to Oaks there in the Ozarks, robbed them, these crooks, tied them to a tree, put a little card, ace over their hearts, blindfolded them, and were about to shoot them when they said, "Do you have any last requests?" And Billy Ray Cyrus said, "Yeah, I'd like to sing Achy Breaky Heart one more time." And they said, "Andy Williams, do you have any last requests?" He said, "Yeah, shoot me first." I can understand that. I don't know that we can relate to every possible type, but somehow eternity is a long time. And Paul says the discipline required is fantastic. Verse 24. "Don't you know that in all the races, every runner runs, only one gets the prize. Run in such a way to get the prize. Everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. They do it to get a crown that will not last. But we do it to get a crown that will last forever. Therefore, I don't run like a man running aimlessly. I don't fight like a man beating the air. I beat my body to make it my slave, so that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified for the prize." He ends this where it has to end. Don't let the relational thing fool you. It's not easy. It's a disciplined work. And the discipline is amazing. We Baptists talk all the time about amazing grace. We don't have a song called Amazing Discipline. But that's what's really amazing. Grace is what God does for you. Discipline, that's what you do for God. Nobody puts a gun to your head and says, "Read the Bible or pray." If those things issue from your life, it It's a gift you give back, sui generis, from your own life unto God. Discipline. Boy, it's the hardest thing. I play the dean racquetball, and I'm afraid not to play. I'm like Hewlett. I sense a little insecurity here. I play my dean racquetball, and when the alarm goes off at 4:30 in the morning, the first thing I hear is my body saying, I'm not going. I say, oh, yes, you are. And I knock my body out on the floor. It says, I don't care. I'm not going. I said, oh, yes, you are. And I prick my body up, and I go into the bathroom and flip on the light and turn on the mirror. And this thing that greets me says, you should listen to me. You shouldn't be doing this. But I understand why Paul, who's probably a little older, can say, I got to make my body serve because I don't want to quit early. Folks, you know something? Jesus is a great boss. And I'm ready to see him anytime he wants me. I look forward to it. But I'll be just real honest with you. I don't want to quit early. If there's someone else out there with whom my relational sphere might intersect, I would like for that to happen. And I would like to finish this race saying, you know what? It's been a relational game. I wanted some theology under it. But I wanted to remember, the average person doesn't know it. And I need to start where they are. And I need to make friends with them in the sermon and in an evangelism call. Because when I do that, and only when I do that well, is there a chance that the world might come to Christ.